This is the Breaker.News podcast for November 19th, 2017. Welcome. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues and institutions. Let us help stop the secrecy and unravel the spin. Later, I will tell you how you can support the Breaker. On this episode, regular features such as the Is It Just Me commentary, Around the Rim with headlines from Japan, South Korea, Alaska, and Malaysia, Cascadia Calling with headlines from British Columbia and Oregon, The Big Deal feature with Integrity BC's Dermot Travis, Did the NDP Do Enough to Ban Big Money?, and ending with a virtual Nanaimo bar for people across BC that deserved it this week. Now, is it just me? Is it just me, or are you tired of politicians playing politics when they should be saving lives and making communities safer? Premier John Horgan turned the sod on a new mental health and addiction center at the Riverview Hospital site in Coquitlam on November 17th. The $101 million center will open in 2019 with 105 beds, but that is just 11 more than the aging Burnaby Center that it will replace. Why can't the NDP do more? BC is facing a mental health and drug crisis. There should be 1,000 new treatment beds. The BC Liberals quickly pointed out that they announced the same plan in 2015. But those are the same BC Liberals who should be ashamed that they closed Riverview in the summer of 2012. Opened in 1913, Riverview became a small town by the 1950s, with 5,000 patients and 2,000 staff. A new Mental Health Act in 1965 got the ball rolling for community-based care. In the 1990s, under the NDP, downsizing and decentralizing were the buzzwords. In 2002, under the BC Liberals, the decision was made to phase out Riverview. Patients were moved to other facilities for mental health care. Meanwhile, the BC Liberals spent the better part of 16 years making it easier to buy booze in BC, making it easier to gamble in BC, and they failed to stop the rise of drug-based organized crime. The mentally ill and addicted of BC fell through the cracks and ended up self-medicating on the streets of the downtown east side, where police officers, ambulance paramedics, and firefighters scramble to keep them alive, or to pick up their dead bodies. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We'll look at news headlines from around the Pacific Rim. First, in the Japan Times, Mizuho Aoki reported that crimes in Japan fell below the 1 million mark last year. The Justice Ministry in Japan said crime reports declined for the 14th consecutive year, and for the first time in the post-war era, they were below the 1 million mark. The government says there are fewer thefts because of more surveillance cameras. But it was not all good news. There are more elderly offenders and more repeat offenders. Also, child abuse tripled from 300 reported cases in 2007 to more than 1,000 in 2016, and domestic violence nearly tripled from 2,800 cases to 7,500. In the Korea Times, Park Si-soo reported that 1.76 million foreigners live in South Korea. That's 3.4% of the population. It was a threefold increase from 537,000 in 2006. Nearly 60% of the foreigners in South Korea live in and around the capital, Seoul. In the Alaska Dispatch News, Michelle Theriault-Boots reported that Alaskans are deluged with social media posts on crime. What's it doing to us? The newspaper asks. It mentions that there's a Facebook group called Anchorage Scanner Joe, which features on-the-scene reports, tips, links, and commentary about crime in Anchorage. On any given day, its content might include posts on stolen trucks, shots fired, rants about junkies, and snippets about surveillance footage and alerts about missing teenagers. This group has 46,000 members, which is more than those who subscribe to the official text message alerts from the Anchorage Police Department. Troy Payne, who is a criminologist at the University of Alaska Anchorage Justice Center, said that a recent study found a direct link between social media consumption and how people feel about their communities. Quote, people who use social media are more likely to feel unsafe, Payne said. In the Star Online in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, Eugene Mahalingam reports that property imbalance is growing wider. The unsold properties in Malaysia are at the highest level in 10 years. During 2017's first quarter, Malaysia counted more than 130,000 unsold properties. That is close to double the historical average of 72,000 between 2004 and 2016. 8 out of 10 units were above the 250,000 Malaysian ringgit threshold. That's 77,000 Canadian dollars. The price of a house in Kuala Lumpur is 5.4 times the median income. Developers are reluctant to build affordable housing in Malaysia because there are low profit margins. Where have we heard that before? That's Around the Rim for this week on the Breaker.News podcast. It's time for Cascadia Calling on the Breaker.News podcast. First, Czech TV in Victoria reported on the juvenile hawk that was rescued from a Langford Costco in critical condition. The newest patient at the Wild Ark Rehab Center was 30% underweight, weak, thin, and dehydrated. The raptor is believed to have been stuck inside the Costco for at least 2 days. A falconer used a trap to rescue the one-year-old bird, but it could take weeks, even months, for it to fly again. Shannon Loof of the Northern View in Prince Rupert, BC, reported that Hammy dodges conservation officers. The Prince Rupert buck, known as Hammy, managed to evade conservation officers who sought to remove the hammock strings attached to the deer's antlers. Officers drove from Terrace and planned to tranquilize the buck and disentangle the purple threads. The deer has been donning the unique gear since mid-August when it became caught in a backyard hammock, hence the nickname Hammy. Local woman Mercedes Mark has started a Chronicles of Hammy Deer official group on Facebook. In the Albany Democrat Herald in Albany, Oregon, Stephen Dubois of the Associated Press reported that Oregon's population keeps rising. It's now at 4.1 million. The state added 65,000 people between July 1, 2016 and July 1, 2017. Migration to Oregon accounted for 88% of the jump, according to the Population Research Center at Portland State University. And finally, Ryan Collingwood of the Spokesman Review in Spokane, Washington, reported in Navy says it will hold Whidbey Island air crew accountable for tracing giant phallus over Okanagan County. Look, up in the sky, it's a bird, it's a plane. No, it's a phallic sky drawing and a military aircraft is the culprit. Okanagan residents told the Spokesman Review that they saw the male genitalia deliberately being drawn in the skies above their town by a jet around noon on November 16th. Images of the drawing were quickly posted to social media and sent around town through text messages. The Naval Air Station in Whidbey Island, Washington, has claimed responsibility for the drawing, calling it unacceptable and, quote, of zero training value. The plane was an EA-18G Growler from the VAQ-130 Electronic Attack Squadron, based at Whidbey Island, on what is described as a routine training flight. That's Cascadia Calling for this week. We welcome Dermot Travis of Integrity BC to the Breaker.News podcast. 4 months ago, on July 18th, John Horgan was sworn in as the new Premier of British Columbia, ending 16 years of BC Liberal rule. The first legislative session under the Greens-supported NDP government is coming to an end by the end of November. And before then, we've got Dermot Travis on the podcast and talking about some of the major democratic reform initiatives that have happened so far this fall. So first of all, Dermot, welcome to the Breaker.News podcast. What is your letter grade that you would give to the NDP, the John Horgan NDP, early on in its mandate as the first legislative session under the NDP comes to a close?
I'm giving them right now a B-, and they would have been a little higher. But the reason for the B- is mostly the result of what I'd call beginner mistakes. And for a party that's been out of power for 16 years, you would expect the party to make some beginner mistakes in government. They get a pass from them on this session. By the session in 2018, they're not going to be able to have the excuse of beginner mistakes any longer. They'll have to be writing it well and competently, and there were a few hiccups along the way in this last session.
Which one or two beginner mistakes or hiccups really stand out in your mind?
I think the biggest hiccup stands out in how badly they handled what should have been their legacy legislation, and that's the legislation over big money in BC politics. I think that they clearly didn't get a good sense of where the public was at on the issue. To the best of my knowledge, they didn't reach out to anyone outside of government to consult on various ideas that they might have been tossing around. As someone who's lived in Quebec for 25 years, it was a routine practice of the Quebec government to reach out to various stakeholder groups, not to show them draft legislation, but just to have casual, informal conversations about ideas that they were considering, to get your reaction to them. And obviously the reaction would then somehow potentially influence or impact on the legislation. I think if the government had chosen to do that over the summer, and they had more than sufficient time to do it, they would have avoided a lot of the mess that they made for themselves on the day that they announced the legislation.
Yeah, two things that are in the legislation that stick out. One is by commission, the other omission. The commission part would be the subsidy for political parties in BC, which was quite controversial, that gave the BC Liberals something to complain about. And the omission is the lack of any new transparency measures on spending of that money. We know how they get donations or who donates to them, but we don't know who they're spending that money with. I think that's a major omission.
Well, I think on the commission side, I think what stood out for me is how both parties, the Green Party and the NDP, wanted to give the other credit for the idea, which demonstrated to me that neither of them really wanted to take credit for it. Here was an idea that John Horgan made very clear to most voters during the election that public subsidies for political parties would be off the table. And there are a number of jurisdictions in Canada that do not provide public subsidies that also ban corporate and union donations, Alberta being one of those provinces. So the idea that it is an automatic with campaign finance reform is not accurate. So it was easy to buy into what John Horgan was saying. To see it in the legislation at the news conference without a hint of it before, I think they lost a golden opportunity to actually set the stage for it. There's a lot of good arguments for public subsidy of political parties. The OECD argues in favor of it. They argue in favor of not being fully public, but they also say it shouldn't be fully private. And because of that, I think people were left scrambling who wanted to defend the government's sort of about-face on the issue. And that was a mistake on their part. They should have seen what was about to hit them and been ready in advance of that news conference to start bringing the population around to the point of view that they were going to put forward. Unfortunately, they also spun it as a transition allowance, suggesting that sometime in the future it may disappear, and that they would have a commission to take a look at whether it should disappear. The problem with the transition allowance is that the Green Party swore off corporate and union donations more than a year ago. The Liberal Party is not in need of a transition allowance, and it really drives home the point that that public subsidy is there first and foremost to help the NDP, and I think what was said at the recent convention in regards to their finances reinforces that. In terms of the omission side, not only do you have the issue of how parties spend their money as being one of the omissions, I think that they missed, one, a golden opportunity to reduce the disclosure requirements in the legislation. Currently, only donors over $250 are disclosed. That has not been changed in the new legislation. Even the Liberal Party proposed lowering it to $100. I think they've made a mistake in that, and I think they've made a mistake in not adding on what information should now be collected about contributors. And the most important piece of information that needs to be collected about contributors is, who is your employer? Because the one lesson from other jurisdictions that have banned corporate and union donations is some companies in particular that have tried to use their employees, our list of what are called in Quebec straw men, to make political donations on their behalf, and that they are then reimbursed. But it is very much corporate money. SNC-Lavalin recently accepted the ruling of Elections Canada in this regard, that they in fact have done that practice for a number of years at the federal level after corporate donations had been banned in the federal arena. So it demonstrates it's not just the odd sort of small construction company that might be looking for one of those loopholes. SNC-Lavalin, one of the major companies in this country, was not only quite prepared to go to the trouble of breaking the law, they did it for a number of years. And that demonstrates to me that BC is going to have to look at our election legislation again when the legislature resumes in 2018.
And that is Dermot Travis from Integrity of BC on the Breaker.News podcast. Thanks for your time, Dermot.
Thank you.
Every week on the Breaker.News, we will end on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo bar to a deserving person or organization that has made a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to first responders, British Columbia's police officers, firefighters, and paramedics, the brave men and the brave women who we rely on every day to keep our communities safe and to help us in times of need. This weekend, Abbotsford Police Constable John Davidson will be laid to rest. He died on the job November 6th, trying to arrest a car thief. Being a first responder is a dangerous job. Few officers are killed by criminals, but many more suffer disabilities, including PTSD. Sometimes they don't survive the stress. We need our governments to give more protection and more support to those that need it. We wish we could buy every one of you in uniform a real Nanaimo bar, but the Breaker has a very modest budget. So we will keep you in our thoughts and urge others to do the same. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for November 19th, 2017. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Send me your feedback and your story ideas. Email bob@thebreaker.news. That's bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and like thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month, like Daryl Greer of Vancouver, who signed up for the $10 NewsHound supporter level. Thank you, Daryl. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. That's patreon.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.